Hello and welcome to Women's Health Explained by Screen Me. I'm your host Jess, and along with a range of wonderful expert guests, I'll be walking you through what you need to know about your own health. We will cover hot topics including hormonal balance, fertility, PCOS, gut health, and so much more. So keep listening and I hope that you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to Fertility Matters with Screen Me. I'm your new host Jessica Hobbis, and today I shall be joined by the wonderful Natalie Sutherland. Natalie Sutherland is a partner at Burgess Mee Law, a modern family law specialist, solicitor and co-founder of Infertility in the City, which is an event series and podcast dedicated to exploring the complex relationship between infertility and professional context, which I'm sure you'll all be super interested in and we'll get onto later. But she's super passionate about helping clients to create their families, and yeah, pretty great lady to speak to today and have on the show. Welcome Natalie, and I guess a great place to start maybe a little bit more about yourself, or also the current UK surrogacy law and the Law Commission reform proposals, which have been in the news recently. So yeah, take it away.
Hi Jess, thank you so much for having me. So surrogacy is very exciting at the moment. So the Law Commission of England and Wales and the Scottish Law Commission announced their recommendations, their long-awaited recommendations, on the 29th of March. They had released a preliminary report in June 2019, and we have been waiting for their final report and the draft bill, and that's finally come out, and all the lawyers and stakeholders and intended parents and surrogates have all been very excited about it. So, but these are just recommendations for the moment. The government has 6 months to come back with a interim reply, and then 12 months for a full response. And of course, we're probably going to have a change of government in that time. So whether or not it becomes law is anyone's guess, but surrogacy reform is very much needed. So it's been really good to get that started now, to have those recommendations and the draft bill. So to talk you through the recommendations at the moment, the law says that the surrogate is the legal mother, regardless of where you undertake your surrogacy. So if you undertake your surrogacy in the US, where the surrogate would not be the legal mother, and you as the intended parents would be on the birth certificate, it doesn't matter. So when you come back to this country, you still have to apply for what's called a parental order. And that is what changes the legal parentage from the surrogate and any spouse to the intended parents. So it's a very important process that all intended parents who have children through surrogacy have to go through. And of course, obviously, if it's domestic surrogacy, they do as well. So, but there is this limbo period. So you have the baby's born, and the baby is with you as the intended parents. Yeah. And but you're not legal parents. You're not able to register the birth in this country. And then you won't have parental responsibility either. And you don't get that until either you get your parental order at the end, or perhaps you might apply for an interim child arrangements order in the interim stage that will give you parental responsibility in the meantime, but not legal parentage. Yeah. So for a period of time, could be a few months, this child is living with you and you have no legal status towards that child. So if, for example, they needed emergency medical treatment, then you as the intended parents, even though you're the biological parents, you're not the legal parents, you couldn't give that permission. You would have to get the surrogate and her spouse's permission for that medical treatment to happen. And of course, if your surrogate is in the Ukraine or Mexico or the US, it might be quite difficult to get hold of them later, you know, after the baby's been born. So, and then also for same-sex couples, the hospital's probably going to have more inquiries about who the legal mother is if you're a same-sex couple than if you are a straight heterosexual couple. Yeah. Perhaps they may not raise any issues, but you don't have the right to make those decisions because you don't have parental responsibility. And this has always been a problem with the current UK surrogacy laws. Mm. So the recommendations from the Law Commission is to change that and sort of flip it on its head so that the intended parents will be the child's legal parents from birth, mm-hmm. provided that it's a domestic surrogacy, so in the UK, not any international case. Mm-hmm. And you comply with certain eligibility criteria, which is very similar to what it is now, but also you comply with all these preconception safeguards, things like having legal advice, criminal records checks, having a surrogacy agreement in place, medical checks. All of that has to be done pre-conception, so before you've even done the embryo transfer. And if you've done all of that and your registered surrogacy organization, so an RSO, have signed off on it, then when the baby's born, you will be the legal parents. Mm. However, what we want to do in this country is maintain the autonomy of the surrogate. Mm-hmm. So as the case is now, the surrogate is that legal mother and she has to consent to the surrogacy arrangement. So she has to consent to the parental order. Mm. And if she doesn't consent to the parental order, the intended parents can't get one. That's it. There's no possibility of the court, the judge, overruling that surrogate's consent, lack of consent,
yeah,
and making the order anyway. So that was always a problem. And that's always what a lot of British IPs have feared, that if a surrogate does not give her consent, they're stuck. Whereas if they go abroad, the surrogate can't change her mind. So when they come back here, that they know they're going to get their parental order because the surrogate isn't able to change her mind over there.
Yeah.
So, but at the moment, with the Law Commission proposals, if during the new pathway, the surrogate will still maintain her ability to object. So mm-hmm. instead of okay. now she has to consent, the consent is assumed mm-hmm. for a period of time. And then the surrogate, if she objects, then different things happen.
Yeah.
And it all depends on the timing of when she gives, when she objects. So if she objects before the birth, then in this new pathway, the intended parents will not be the legal parents at birth. The surrogate will. Mm-hmm. And then the intended parents will have to apply for a parental order just like they do now.
Okay.
If the surrogate objects 6 weeks after birth, then it will be the, I think it's after 6 weeks, the surrogate will have to then apply for the parental order. This is entirely new. So the surrogate yeah. has never had to, you know, be an applicant in these proceedings.
Yeah.
So because we need certainty as to who the legal parent is, but we also want the surrogate to have that ability to object. So yeah. in that scenario, the surrogate will be the applicant. So she will be wanting to tell the court, right, I don't agree. I don't consent to this yeah. Surrogacy arrangement anymore. I think I should be the legal parent. And she will have to convince the court that that is in the child's best interest.
Yeah.
And then, of course, if for the intended parents, if they are the ones that have to apply for the parental order because the surrogate has objected, what has changed now is the court will, well, it hasn't changed yet, but in the recommendations, the court will have the power to veto that surrogate's lack of consent. So now, or in the future, the court will have that power, which they don't have at the moment. Okay, so yeah. at least, you know, if there is any kind of surrogacy arrangement where the intended parents and surrogates have fallen out and the court does need to figure out what's in the child's best interests, they will have that power to make the parental order. So give the legal parentage to the intended parents, even if the surrogate doesn't want that, provided that it's in the child's lifelong welfare best interests. So yeah. these are big things that are happening.
Definitely.
And I think it's a really good thing. And if this becomes law, then mm. I think it strikes a really good balance between the rights of the surrogate and her ability mm. to have her autonomy recognised and be able to be the legal parent to a child she's given birth to, if that's what she wants.
Yeah.
But also the intended parents, it gives them a bit more autonomy and understanding that they will have this legal mm. parentage, provided that they have yeah. met all these requirements. And importantly, for the child, that you know, this legal limbo that they have at the moment won't be there, assuming, of yeah. course, that they their parents have undergone all the relevant checks. So there, you know, in the press, there's been some people that said that the recommendations haven't gone far enough. And I can yeah. see that, because a lot of intended parents, they want to have that certainty. They want yeah, to be able definitely. To have that, right, when I'm an intended, have that baby born, it's biologically related to me, I want there to be that certainty. I don't want the surrogate to have to change her mind. But I just, honestly, I don't think we are going to have that in this jurisdiction. It's not the California model. We want altruistic surrogacy. We don't want commercial surrogacy. So so I think yeah. it's never going to go that far. But how far they've come, I think mm-hmm. it's a really good thing.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's also so important to protect the surrogates' rights themselves. And so I think making yeah, those small
absolutely.
Things.
UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
How is the community as a whole? You mentioned a bit that's in the news. How's the community itself kind of responded to it? Is this something the majority are in favour for, including the surrogates themselves? I guess, yeah. How does that stand in the community at the moment?
I think generally it's been received well. Okay. Not-for-profit surrogacy agency. So you have My Surrogacy Journey, Brilliant Beginnings, COTS, Nappy Endings,
yeah.
Surrogacy UK, Brilliant Beginnings. So these are all not-for-profit surrogacy agencies that help intended parents find their surrogates. But under these new proposals, they will turn into regulated surrogacy organisations, RSOs, regulated by the HFEA, which this hasn't been done before.
Yeah.
So that's a whole new thing. And these agencies are going to have to do a lot of work. I mean, it's quite staggering, actually, how important their role is going to be, not only in the matching side, but in overseeing the journey from both the intended parents and the surrogate's point of view. Also dealing with the expenses. So at the moment, there's been a lot of, you know, murmurings about the expenses that the Law Commission have recommended. So previously, currently in the law, you're not allowed to have commercial surrogacy in this jurisdiction, although if you go abroad and enter into a commercial surrogacy arrangement over there, that will be permitted as long as you seek retrospective permission for those expenses. But here, you're only supposed to pay the surrogate reasonable expenses. But there's no definition of what that is. So there's quite a lot of grey area as to what the surrogate can charge, what the intended parents should be paying for, should not be paying for. And in the surrogacy cases that I've dealt with where there's been a breakdown in the relationship, a lot of it comes down to money. Yeah. So what the Law Commission are saying now in their recommendations is that there are mandatory payments, so things that the intended parents absolutely have to pay for, things like life insurance for the surrogate. Categories of payments which are permitted, and that will be things like maternity clothes, travel to the clinic, loss of earnings, all stuff that we know that the intended parents were paying to the surrogate anyway, but these are now clarified that this is what's allowed. And then there's a category of payments that's absolutely prohibited. So payments for her services, which would be the commercial element. But it's also including things now like living expenses, including rent. So I just wonder how the surrogates might feel about that, because I can imagine that, you know, when they calculate their expenses, there'll be an element of that. But from the intended parents' point of view, you can see, well, that type of thing is what you would pay for anyway, whether you're a surrogate or not, that would be your cost. So for the intended parents, I think it's clarified those payments that are not allowed. The only thing I was a bit concerned about is the potential for criminal liability and how the RSOs have to police this, essentially. So we're going to have to look at, I mean, the bill will need to be debated in Parliament, and I need to get to grips with the 600 odd pages of the report, but hopefully that will all be ironed out. But that's the headline at the moment.
Yeah. Do you see a kind of shift towards this commercial surrogacy, or do you think that's something that's not possible?
I don't think that'll ever happen here. We have gone so far as to say that commercial surrogacy is not against public policy in another jurisdiction.
Yeah.
There is the Whittington case, so that allowed in a medical negligence claim, the woman was allowed to claim money for to enable her to undergo surrogacy in California.
Yeah.
So where it's commercial. So and that was not that on appeal, that was not considered to be commercial. So that's a good thing. And but yeah, I honestly don't think we will ever go to a full commercial model here. We've heard from, you know, the research from surrogates is that they don't want that. They don't, because they're worried about this idea that they're selling their baby, which they're not, because of course, you know, they are carrying this child for the intended parents with, you know, no wish to be the legal parent of that child.
Yeah.
But the paying of services might muddy the waters. Whereas if they're just not out of pocket, but not in profit, then it's more palatable for everybody. Although, I mean, and this might be controversial, but everybody else is paid. So your lawyers, your RSOs, the clinics,
all these
people charge for their services. Whereas the surrogate, who, you know, is the one who's most at risk with her health, doesn't get paid.
Well, so, I guess there's multiple reasons for why you would be a surrogate. So I guess it makes it very difficult in the end. Super, super interesting. I'm sure a lot more legal work is going to go on in the area, especially with reforms. But I guess this kind of takes us on to the idea of legal parenthood, as you kind of discussed with the surrogacy laws. Mm-hmm. So if I were thinking about surrogacy myself, and wanted to know the issues of legal parenthood in different situations, what would kind of be your advice from a legal standpoint? Just because, as we've kind of just touched on, it's very confusing and very, different rules for different things and different loopholes you need to jump through. So what would kind of be your basic advice or basic rundown of for someone who's looking at surrogacy?
Well, first of all, take legal advice. There's, you know, this is not the corner to cut, I don't think. I think before you go down this route, you should be understanding who is the legal parent and who is not the legal parent.
Yeah.
So, for example, not just in a surrogacy case, but in, let's say it's a same-sex female couple and they are using donor conception. So they want a sperm donor. What you need to understand is that the marital status of the birth mother and where you conceive is what will decide who is the legal parent and who is not the legal parent.
Okay.
And there's nothing you can do about, you know, changing that by any kind of agreement. So, for example, let's say the same-sex couple are not married and they have a sperm donor not through a UK licensed clinic. Okay. So this is a friend, even not a friend, somebody that they found on a co-parenting website, for example, or a sperm donor website or Facebook.
And may I just interject, a civil partnership, does that count as marital status in this context?
Yes. Okay. Absolutely. So if you're civil partnered or married, I'll come on to that. But if you're single, but in a couple and not civilly partnered and not married, and you conceive via artificial insemination from a known donor outside of a UK clinic, that donor will be the legal parent and your same-sex female partner will not be because you're not married and you're not doing it in the UK clinic.
And there's no way of changing that.
No. So what happens is, even if you have an agreement that says that this known donor is not, you won't apply for maintenance against him. It's not worth the paper it's written on, essentially, because if you fell out, then the sperm donor could make applications to court and you could make applications to the child maintenance. Yeah. So the way around that is to either use a UK licensed clinic and use an unknown donor. It won't be fully anonymous. The child can know who the donor is at age 18. But if you use a clinic and fill out the right forms, then even if you're not married, your same-sex female partner will then be the second legal parent and will go on the birth certificate. So that is your way of doing of being able to ensure that you have that legal status if you're not married. But if you are married or in a civil partnership, then if you do artificial insemination outside of the clinic, then that donor is not the legal parent.
Yeah.
people don't, you know, if you had and conceive and realize that now, for example, I mean, I've had an inquiry recently where they have done known donation outside of a clinic, not married, about to get married, and now they're going to have to go through adoption to be able to have that legal parentage. But had they married before they conceived, it wouldn't be a problem. So it's understanding the different nuances for your specific situation. So yeah. I would always say go and get that legal advice and tell your lawyer what your situation is, and they can give you that advice of what to do, what not to do, when to do it. So yeah, that's what I would advise.
Yeah, absolutely. That seems like such a minefield almost, with knowing the right thing to do in which situation. That's super interesting and super helpful for the listeners, I imagine. Also with regards to, I guess, the law with storage laws. So I know there was the increase recently for egg sperm freezing. But what do you think are the kind of regulations around that, the pitfalls of storing embryos even as well? If you progress to that stage, I guess, yeah, kind of the issues of consent surrounding that and things like that. Yeah.
So the storage law, so the storage of egg, sperm and embryos changed last summer. So whereas before, if you had a medical reason, so you were prematurely infertile, you could store your gametes for up to 55 years. But if you were storing just for social reasons, so you're not prematurely infertile, but you want to store your eggs because you haven't found a partner yet, or you want to concentrate on your career, that type of thing, a non-medical reason, you would be restricted to only 10 years of storage.
Okay.
So let's say you stored your eggs at age 25. Unless you're ready to use them by age 35, they'd have to come out of storage, and it would just be a complete waste of 10 years of storage fees. So, and of course, that's slight, you know, discrimination between different categories of people who get to store. And Progress Educational Trust, which is a charity that I'm a trustee of, campaigned heavily to change these laws. And I'm pleased to say that it did change. Okay. So now, if you are storing for social reasons as well as medical reasons, you can store for up to 55 years. You do have to re-consent every 10 years if it's for your own use. So, yeah. There is still that 10 years that... that's going to require you to say yes, I still want to continue storing. And of course, you know, that then it does raise the issue of what do you do with those embryos or eggs or whatever if you don't want to use them. Do you discard them? Do you donate them to somebody else?
Yeah.
Do you donate them to science and research, that type of thing? Lots of people just put it off because, you know, they don't want to have to, but those are issues to look out for. And then the other thing that I try to educate people on is when if you store your own gametes, so your own sperm and your own eggs, without it actually creating an embryo, then it's up to you what you do with those gametes because they're yours.
Yeah.
But the minute that you create an embryo with somebody else, you have that it's not your own autonomous gametes anymore. You will have to deal with that other person. So, for example, if you have stored embryos together, you've gone through IVF and you've created, let's say, 10 embryos, and you've used one, you've had a child together, or you haven't, and you've got these other embryos in storage. If you later split up, then your partner could withdraw their consent for you to be able to use those embryos.
Yeah.
And there really isn't very much we as lawyers can do to get around that, because consent is very much the cornerstone of our fertilization and, you know, human fertilization and embryology laws. So so that is something that is very difficult. So in America, there are certain states where if you are, let's say, undergoing cancer treatment, and this is your last chance to have a biological children, then you may be able to convince the court that you should be able to use those embryos, even if your partner says they don't want to become a father. But in this jurisdiction, it's really difficult. So the way to get around that, if you know, is to store. Make sure you store your own eggs, sperm separately, so that. If then you couldn't use those embryos you've created together with your current partner, then you would already have eggs in storage to be able to create embryos with donor sperm or a new partner without having to undergo another egg retrieval. And of course, you know, if you underwent an egg retrieval because you were going to go through chemo, then once that's done, you you probably lost your fertility and wouldn't be able to undergo another egg retrieval. So, but I mean, a lot of people, they tend to store or freeze embryos because they do thaw better than eggs. But vitrification, the fast freezing technology that's come up in the last few years, that has helped the thawing of eggs so that they are more viable now. So,
got it. That's a great piece of advice, especially paired with the increase in amount of time you're able to freeze your eggs for. I think that's super interesting. And I think, yeah, a great piece of advice for the listeners, I guess.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Kind of touching on the egg and sperm freezing and donor conception and things like that, what is the current position for children conceived through a donor with regards to finding out the status and things like that?
So prior to 2005, it would be anonymous. So you wouldn't have been able to find that information unless post 2005, those donors have changed their status and want to be contactable. Yeah. But from 2005, all donations have to be, so the donors have to understand that when any child that's born from their donation turns 18, they have the right to know who their donor is. So that's name, last known address, date of birth, so they can be contactable. So that's a big change. And 2023 is the first year of any children born in 2005 when the law changed who would be able to access that information. So the HFEA are poised for, you know, having these people contact them to find out this information. But of course, 18 years is a long time. So who knows how that's going to work in terms of whether people have moved and kept their details up to date, but with a name and a date of birth and address, you probably are going to be able to find people. But of course, what it requires is for those children now, adults, to know their donor conceived, to be able to then ask for that information. So if you are if you're raised in a same-sex couple, you're likely going to know from very early on that you are donor conceived. If you are in a heterosexual couple, there's a possibility that your parents haven't told you. So and then you're not going to be the one that at 18 finds out about your donor because you don't know that you're donor conceived. You think your parents are your parents. But in the last few years, these straight-to-consumer donor testing kits have become very, very popular. So 23andMe, Ancestry.com, really easy kits where you just spit into a tube and then send off your spit. And then they analyse your DNA and are able to give you details of your ancestry. Yeah. So people that you share DNA with.
Yeah.
So for those people who do that, perhaps they get it as a Christmas present and, you know, they just do it for a bit of fun. There's been so much, you know, I listen to podcasts and read articles about this. It happens all the time. These people are finding out in their later life that they're donor conceived through these tests.
Yeah.
So and they're, you know, they're cheap, they're readily accessible, and you don't even have to have your donor to take the test and have their DNA on the database for you to figure out that you're potentially donor conceived because you've got all these siblings, half siblings that you didn't know you had. So at the moment, the HFEA is actually looking at reforming the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Act to deal with this donor anonymity. Because in 2005, when they changed it to be identity release at age 16, non-identifying information at 16, and then identifying information at 18, I don't think DNA testing was thought of at that point. It was not the norm, whereas it is now. So there's a lot of argument to say, well, you know, should we just give this information to the parents or the children during their childhood? And if so, when? You know, is it information that should be given to the parents? Do they want to have access to medical information during the childhood? Do they want to have access to siblings during their childhood? That type of thing. So there's a consultation on at the moment, which closes soon, about whether or not people think that this is a good idea. So I'd encourage lots of people to, if they have opinions on this, to complete the HFEA consultation.
Oh, wow. That's super interesting. I think something that we're definitely going to be seeing then in the next few years, particularly as it's 2023 now. It'll be really interesting to watch that space, I think. Thank you so much for that. And I think also then coming on to yourself and a bit of the work that you do with infertility in the city, I think it'd be great to know a bit more about what you guys do, the events that you guys have planned with regards, and just a little bit about you guys and the conversations around fertility in the workplace.
So infertility in the city started in September 21. So with a conversation between myself and Sumeya Wazani, who is a CEO and founder of Mimosa Fleur, a recruitment company. So she and I knew each other, and we got together for a coffee one day and talked about our own fertility challenges and how this has impact on careers, and how much we know that not only trying to conceive, but also becoming pregnant and having children and then coming back to work as lawyers is quite difficult. There's this perception around women who go off and have babies that they're not as committed about their job, they're not committed about reaching partner or getting that promotion, being hard at work, and that's rubbish. So we wanted to tackle this perception that women who go off and have babies, or women who are trying to have babies, are not as committed. And you know, we work hard for our careers and we want to continue with our careers once we've had children. We want both, just as men have both. So we started off by having an in-person event in December 21, and we had a few lawyers from associates to partners of global law firms. We had an in-house lawyer from Channel 4 and a fertility at work coach, Emma Menzies, on the panel talking about their own personal experiences. And we had about 60 people in the audience, and it was so engaging, and everyone was so so passionate about it. And the feedback we got on social media afterwards was that this is a conversation that needs to be had. So we planned another event in July. This time we had load of different speakers. We doubled our numbers. We had about 120 in the audience, and again, it was massively successful. And in the meantime, the background, we were planning this podcast, which we then released in October. So myself, Sumeya, and Emma Menzies, the fertility at work coach, the three of us interview people professionals, whether they be lawyers or in any other kind of context, who want to talk about how their trying to conceive journey has impacted on their careers, whether that be miscarriage or they need to have IVF or everything from in between. So we have these open and honest conversations, and the feedback we've had across all platforms has been absolutely amazing. So we've even just won an award as well.
Oh, congratulations.
We love it.
I think that's so important to open up that conversation and just to normalize it. I think infertility is something that a lot of couples struggle with. Mm-hmm. And so I think opening up that is really brave and also super inspiring. Obviously you started the podcast really recently, which I'll link below everything so everyone can go have a listen as well. Are there any events that you have planned, or where do you kind of see it in the future moving on to?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're currently recording season 2. So we hope that's going to be released later this month. Ooh. With with season three later in the year. So the plan is to do two seasons a year. So we did the one at the end of last year. We've had two events now, and we really want to do another event. So so hopefully that will come either late spring, early summer, because lots of people are asking us about it. So we definitely want to continue the momentum and have these events. And if anybody listening has their own fertility story and have professional careers, we're always looking out for people who might want to come on to the podcast to share.
Yeah, definitely. I would recommend anyone to get in touch with you. I think it's such an important topic. I know we at Screamy do a lot of work with workshops in the workplace to kind of educate people on this. But I think there's also something so special about listening to people's actual stories that have been through it. And I think that's something that's so key and makes people realize that it can be quite an isolating time, I imagine. And to kind of realize that a lot of people do go through this is something really inspiring. And I'm very excited to keep up to date with all of this and maybe attend one of the events. That's super interesting.
Oh, wonderful. Yay.
No, thank you so much for coming on. It was super interesting to talk to you. I guess, is there anything else that you kind of want to say to any listeners before we finish?
Just that if anybody has any type of modern family law query, please do get in touch. I'd love to help anybody who's listening.
Yeah, that would be so good. Thank you so much for coming on. And-